The Tom Woods Show, episode 673.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, it's almost that time. Bob Murphy and I are putting on the event of the year. It's the Contra Cruise, setting sail in October 2016. We've got game show style games in store for you. We got music and karaoke. We got great fellowship sessions, a live recording of the current episode of Contra Krugman, and much more. So check it out at ContraCruise.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. It's time once again to check in with our old friend Eric Peters of EricPetersAutos.com, or for short, just EPAutos.com, to find out what's going on in the world of automobiles and liberty. And I'm telling you, there is no authority you want to consult more on this subject than the great, heroic, and brilliant, incredibly knowledgeable Eric Peters. Eric, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here.
We got a bunch of items to talk about. Let's start with Hillary Clinton's views on driving 55 miles an hour. You have an item up at EricPetersAutos.com on this. And it is true that she made these remarks about 10 years ago. But as we were saying before we started recording, it seems unlikely that her position on this has evolved the way her position on gay marriage evolved. You know, if a position she holds seems to be unpopular after a while, by a fascinating coincidence, at the exact moment that happens, her opinion changes. But I'm afraid her opinion always seems to change in one particular direction. It doesn't seem likely to change on this one.
I highly doubt it. I think that Hillary has demonstrated that she's an instinctive control freak. And instinctive control freaks really love the idea of restricting speeds. That's one of their things, the idea that anybody would drive, you know, in air quotes, too fast for their liking. And it's particularly interesting with regard to Hillary because probably she hasn't driven a car herself in 30 years.
And I'm sure the cars that do drive her are going exactly 55 all the time.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you ever had the misfortune to encounter one of our dear leaders or even our sub-dear leaders, little processions with the motorcycles and the armored limos as they go blasting around the corner at top speed, you'll know perfectly well that they're not restricted by drive 55 or anything else.
What are the reasons for driving 55? I mean, basically what it's boiled down to, safety and gas usage. So she says her statement was the 55-mile speed limit really does lower gas usage, and wherever it can be required and the people will accept it, we ought to do it. So she's focusing only on the lower gas, but I'm sure they probably also tried to justify it on safety grounds.
Well, I haven't heard that. The emphasis has always been on saving fuel. And, you know, if
But hold on a minute. Hold on. But surely, though, there's a reason that we have a speed limit at all, and that would be safety, right?
Well, allegedly, yeah. It's this idea that, you know, velocity equals risk. You know, the faster the velocity, the greater risk. It's kind of a non sequitur. You know, every day you've got airplanes out there at 30,000 and 40,000 feet that are operating at 500 to 600 miles an hour, and yet they're not crashing into each other and dropping out of the sky. And it's the same is true with cars.
All right. So what's the deal with wouldn't we actually save gas if we went more slow? I mean, I can think of how I would respond to that, but I got to hear the Eric Peters response to that, because it does seem, you know, you can see the government saying that we have this limited resource and we have to go to war for it half the time in their view. So what are we going to do?
Well, first of all, let's dismiss this idea that it's a limited resource. You know, I'm pushing 50, and my entire life I've been hearing about peak oil and how we're on the verge of running out. And yet, there seems to be more oil than ever. And if you look at the cost of fuel right now, notwithstanding that it's gone up a little bit, it's actually cost less right now in real terms than it did in 1970. And, you know, if something costs less and is in more abundant supply, that kind of indicates that there's probably plenty of it. The peak oil fallacy is just that. It's this. It was based on what was possible technically in the late 1950s and the 60s in terms of identifying where oil was and bringing it to the surface economically. Well, you know, it's 50 years down the road, and technology has improved, and there are more sophisticated ways of identifying deposits and bringing them up, and that's reflected in the low cost of the oil and the gas right now. So that's the first point. And the second point I'd make is that people like Hillary, politicians generally, tend not to be very mechanically minded, not to know very much about things like math and science. And the whole 55 thing is as dated as an 8-track tape player. It goes back 40 years. back when most cars had three-speed automatic transmissions or maybe a four-speed manual. And you would see a significant fuel economy increase by reducing the speed. But modern cars, typically if they have an automatic, have at least six, and many of the current ones have seven, eight, nine, and soon 10 speeds with multiple overdrive gears on the top. Most manuals have at least six forward gears. And they're designed to operate as efficiently at 75 as the cars of the past were designed to operate at 50.
I'm looking now at a report. This is just the executive summary, a Cato Institute report back in 1999, talking about what happened in the years following the repeal of the 55-mile-an-hour federal speed limit law, where the states then were actually allowed to make a decision on how we really entrusted them with this important decision of what the speed limit should be. And it says, in 1995, the Republican Congress repealed this law. At the time, the highway safety lobby and consumer advocacy groups made apocalyptic predictions about 6,400 increased deaths and a million additional injuries if posted speed limits were raised. And Ralph Nader, who has been a guest on this show, even said that history will never forgive Congress for this assault on the sanctity of human life. But almost all measures of highway safety show improvement, not more deaths and injuries since 1995. 33 states raised their speed limits immediately after the repeal of the mandatory federal speed limit, but the traffic death rate dropped to a record low level in 1997. So
right.
I bet there was a profuse apology from the highway safety lobby and consumer advocacy groups after that.
Well, that there never is when it comes to this stuff. You know, when they're proved wrong in a way that ought to really embarrass anyone, they're never called on it. And I'd like to make a little point about this, you know, the safety issue. Arguably, if you are out on the road and you are made by the law to drive at a speed that is not appropriate for the road, not appropriate for the conditions, too slow, you tend to get, you know, bored and you start to nod off. And that in and of itself is a problem with regard to safety. If you are actively involved in the driving of your car, driving it at an appropriate speed, and by the way, the interstates were designed in the 50s and with the idea that most cars, assuming 1950s cars, okay, with bias tires, four-wheel drum brakes, and the technology of the 50s, would safely operate at 70 to 75 miles an hour. So that's, what, 60 years ago.
Well, you know, and another thing, I'm looking at this, consumer advocacy groups. What arrogance.
Yes.
That they're going to – I mean, I think I can make – I'm the consumer. I don't need them. Who told them that I needed their representation? I'll make my own decision regarding the trade-off between speed and gas usage and my gas budget and whatever. Why would I need them to represent me? I'll make my own decisions.
Yeah, it's very what I call cloverific, you know, this idea, the effrontery that some people are possessed of, that they can speak for us, they presume to speak for us, and then dictate to us what our choices are going to be. And on this business of saving gas, well, wait a minute now, I paid for the gas that I put in my car, right? I just bought it. So if it's my gas, I should be free to use it however I wish to use it, shouldn't I?
Yeah, I mean, right.
Why are these people asserting ownership over the fuel that I just purchased? Now, you know, they have an argument if they're paying for it, but they're not. I mean, I'm not paying for the gas I put in my car. And if I want to drive a car that's got a big, powerful engine and uses more fuel than a car with a smaller engine, well, I feel like that ought to be my right.
Let's shift gears now. I want to talk about something you wrote about the Blue Lives Matter movement. So, yeah. So tell me what that's all about and what your take on it is.
Well, it's kind of in response to the whole Black Lives Matter thing, ostensibly. There's a guy in the governor of Louisiana, John Bell Edwards, who's one of the people who's pushing this. But it's very different from the Black Lives Matter thing. The complaint that the Black Lives Matter people have, which I think is entirely legitimate, is that cops view their lives as less valuable than their own lives. And I think that's abundantly clear, and not just with regard to blacks. I think generally cops view our lives as less important than their lives. For example, they're constantly openly saying that their safety, their perceived safety, whether they feel safe, you know, justifies putting us in the crosshairs of a gun, literally. So it's really concerning because it's of a piece with this business of giving people rights, different rights, and I'll put it in air quotes, based upon things like their sex or their orientation or whether they're male or female, things like that. Well, it's idiotic. You know, rights are universal if they're real rights. Everybody has the same and equal right.
Okay, but I can imagine people coming back and saying, you may not like some of the laws that the police have to enforce. You may not like a lot of the police themselves, but they are performing a service that even in a completely free market would be performed by someone. And it is it's exaggerated how risky it is. There are far more dangerous professions to be in, but it's more dangerous than being an actuary, for example. And so we ought to respect that people are trying to uphold the law against the bad guys. And so maybe they do deserve a little extra consideration. I think that'd be the response.
Well, first of all, the majority of the things that they do, they enforce laws, and that's their own term. They're law enforcement. That's the chosen appellation that they have picked for themselves. And their primary obligation is not to protect us. It is to enforce laws. And I think I submit to you that the majority of the laws that they enforce are statutory laws that involve no harm caused to anybody, that are merely affronts to a statute. Things like ranging from the, buckle up for safety, or whether you choose to put a certain arbitrarily decreed to be illegal substance into your body, things of that nature. If they were to restrict themselves to keeping the peace, that is to dealing with people who violate the rights of others, who hurt other people, who abuse other people's property and so on, I think I'd be more sympathetic to them. And certainly I think most people in a voluntarist or a free society, which I wish we had, would happily support that and pay for that. But that is not what they do chiefly, unfortunately, and I think that's one of the reasons why people, including middle-class people, white people now, increasingly find themselves at odds with law enforcement.
The average person, though, this is an objection I want to hear addressed. I get a lot of libertarians who just don't like the police, and they want to stick it to the police. My only interaction with the police ever has been when I've been pulled over for speeding. I've never had any other problem with them. And I don't want to sound like some naive idiot saying, well, if you don't cause trouble, you won't have any problems. But, I am a regular guy who does regular things, and I don't shout from a bullhorn at 2 o'clock in the morning and then shout police state when somebody carts me away. So what am I missing here by having this kind of regular guy view of the situation?
Well, I don't know. I'm a regular guy, too. Most of my interactions with police have been of the same kind, except with regard to random checkpoints, which really kind of gets my back up. This happened to me just recently, in fact. I was driving home, and they had one of those, sobriety dragnet-style checkpoints where they stop people without any probable cause, without any reason to suspect you of having done anything at all, compel you to submit to a cursory search of your vehicle, to a cursory interrogation, and, to have your papers presented. And it sticks in my craw because I think that fundamentally that is something that should not occur in a free society. And I think that it has helped to acclimate the public to this police state that exists and is growing and to me is very disquieting, and I'd like to see it stopped. I think that if you as an individual have not done something to cause harm or to give a reasonable person a reason to believe that you are about to do something wrong, the police should have no business with you whatsoever, and legally speaking, you should be free to walk away. And the cop should have absolutely no legal basis to detain you, to harass you in any way.
Well, I did a couple of episodes in which this subject of the checkpoints came up. I was talking to a lawyer named Warren Redlich, who's had a lot of success telling people exactly what they should do and what they're allowed to do and what they are not required to do at these checkpoints. So I'm going to link to those episodes also at tomwoods.com/673, which is the show notes page for this episode. Let's talk about your libertarian lexicon. I'm also going to be linking to all the items that we've been talking about. That'll also be at tomwoods.com/673. Let's talk about your libertarian lexicon because it reminded me of a funny, very effective thing that some friends of mine did in college that I think needs to be updated for today. But what's the need for this libertarian lexicon? And other than Clover, which is kind of restricted to your site, what are some terms that people need to know the real meaning of?
Well, verbiage is important, as you know. It defines the term of any discussion that you have, and I think it's important to not let certain terms go without definition. You have to use that as the basis of your discussion. Now, with regard to some of the terms I've mentioned in the article, of course, Clover is a term that's kind of inside baseball, the EP autos, but that's kind of a shorthand term for people who are kind of a passive, unconscious control freak. They're they're generally not bad people. They're not the kind of people who would attack you and threaten you with a gun out in public or walk over to your house and knock on your door and try to make you do what they want. But in a very glib and unconscious way, nonetheless, their entire worldview is based on violence. They vote for politicians who are then going to do violent things to other people as a proxy. You know, they don't feel any compunction about doing that. That's one category of people. And another category of people is a hero. And I use that as a kind of turnabout on the term that's used by themselves. And a hero is an armed government worker, that is, a cop or a soldier. That's what they are. I mean, it's a brutal term, but I think it's an accurate and fair term. Another term that I use is uncle, and that's just shorthand for Uncle Sam. That is the federal government, the personification of the federal Leviathan that has his nose in our business to the nth degree.
I want to mention what I was telling you before. We did I can't take any credit for it, but it was the publication I worked for in college did I forget exactly how they named it, but it was some kind of lexicon of commonly used words and phrases. And the point of it was that we found that on our campus there was a suffocating left liberal bias everywhere, and it extended all the way down into the language that was used, the way people would be described, the terms that would be used in the student newspaper. So, for instance, an ordinary conservative would be called an ultra-conservative, mm-hmm. or just an obvious moderate would be called a conservative. You know, so they were always off in a left-wing direction. Or, you know, hatred. Well, you know, hatred obviously just means
disagreement.
Exactly. You have an unapproved view. So we came up with this whole, and we had like 50 to 70 of these words, and it was hilarious because they were obviously correct that you look at these. So what we're trying to do is translate these words the way the left used them into ordinary language so that people will know what it means when they're accused of hate or what it means when they're accused. And now that we have the social justice warrior group out there, and they've got all kinds of crazy words, you know, microaggression, all these crazy non-concepts are out there. I think it's time to redo that lexicon. I actually think that could be made into a short novelty kind of book that would sell like crazy. I don't have time to do it, but somebody out there's got to be clever enough to come up with the left liberal lexicon, you know, that you could pitch to a huge number of people. I mean, libertarians and conservatives, and it would be a cute little novelty book, and I think it would sell really well. Now, I'm almost talking myself into doing it, but I refuse. I am not taking on any additional projects. Tell me what's coming up here. Okay, it's May of 2016. As somebody who is, let's see, by the time people are hearing this, it'll be June of 2016. As somebody who is an observer of automobiles specifically, leaving out the liberty aspect, what part of year is the most eventful for you? Let's say, is the new model year the same for all models, or is it staggered throughout the year? When do things get interesting?
Well, actually, it used to be that, you know, the new models tended to all show up toward fall, but now they are staggered because there's much more competition in every segment. So some manufacturers will bring out next model year's car literally within the first or second month of the calendar year. So it's gotten to the point where it's sort of a rolling rollout. So you just kind of have to keep abreast of the developments that are happening. One thing that doesn't pertain necessarily to new models but that is burgeoning right now is this Takata airbag scandal. Are you familiar with it?
No, tell me about it.
Well, initially it was thought to affect only certain Japanese manufacturers, particularly Honda, which bought airbags from a big supplier called Takata. It's a Japanese company. But as it turns out, Toyotas and Subarus and then a number of domestic models also have these airbags. And these are the bags that are defective by design and have actually exploded and sprayed shrapnel, metal pieces, into people's faces. And I think they've killed people, and I know that they've harmed a number of people severely. Taken out eyes, ripped out flesh, and so on, and things of that nature. And it affects literally millions of cars. And the problem is how to deal with this. The dealer networks are absolutely overwhelmed with the number of cars that are affected. So one thing that's being looked into, which I favor, and I think this would be a good opportunity, actually, is for the federal government to accede to the legal installation of a cutoff switch if your car is affected, so you can turn the damn thing off so that you don't have to worry about having it blow up in your face, you know, while you drive around for 6 months or a year waiting for them to get to your particular car to fix it.
Well, this makes me think of the general issue of airbags. I know what I've read about them, and I know what I've basically read is that the seatbelt, by and large, is a good thing to wear, but that the airbag may do more harm than good. Has there been any improvement? Is it just the nature of the airbag that it's going to be this way? What's the real truth of it?
Well, let's get back to the point that you made earlier about the consumer advocate. I don't need anybody making these decisions for me. I think that in a free country, whether it's seatbelts or airbags, the device ought to be made available by manufacturers if they believe that there's a demand for it. And if you or I as an individual think that, you know, that's something I'd like to have and I'm willing to pay for it, great. That's the way it ought to be. What I object to is that these things are forced upon us by consumer advocates and by similar people within the federal government who have taken it upon themselves to make decisions for us as if we're idiot children and they're our parents. That's the philosophical point that I'd make. As far as the practical or utilitarian distinction between the two, everything is a risk, reward, cost, benefit analysis. Safety belts generally are good. However, you know, there have been cases of people who've been trapped in a car that's, for example, gone off the side of the road into water or it's on fire. It's not likely, it's not common, but again, it's something that I think it's your life and it therefore ought to be your choice. Airbags are more technically complicated. You're dealing with literally an explosive device, quite literally, inside the car, several of them. Most new cars have at least six. A number of new cars have more than eight or even 10 or 11 of the things. Each one has a tiny explosive cartridge, a gas that explodes rapidly and causes the bag to inflate. And it's inherently potentially a dangerous thing. They have hurt people. They have killed people. And again, that is why this type of thing ought to be up to the individual to decide for themselves to have or not have.
And you could do that by simply not mandating anything, and then people could decide, they could make the trade-off between safety, you know, how much safety they want and how much comfort they want,
sure.
And then they could come up with a bundle that makes sense for them. And that goes for absolutely everything. We've often said about when it comes to the airlines that simply privatizing the TSA is not the answer, because you take a private firm that has to enforce government rules. That's not going to be – okay, so they'll more efficiently enforce crazy government rules. That's not the
point. Right.
We want to privatize the whole thing, including the rules. And so some airlines will be more restrictive and they'll be more invasive in the search, and some will be less. And so you'll see if maybe there are some that are, as a result, safer or less safe. You'll just have to see that and you'll have to make your own decision. And that then everybody will be happy. Everybody will get the bundle of desired outcomes and traits that person wants. To me, that's so obvious. I don't even understand the other side. And at least normally, even when I don't agree with it, I at least understand the other side. I don't even understand why I can't make that choice. You don't have to make it.
Here's another way to look at it. You know, right now I could go out if I wanted to and go to Wendy's and have a triple burger with bacon. But I also have the choice to go out and have, let's say, a chicken breast with lettuce on it. I'm free to make that choice for myself based on what's important to me, whether it's the calorie count or the amount of fat, et cetera, and so on. And can you imagine how preposterous it would be if we had the government telling us, you can't have more than one hamburger and only one patty in any given week, or you must have a skinned chicken breast because it's healthy and safe for you? Well, that's kind of, I think, where we're ultimately headed. You know, the philosophy behind the things like the seatbelts and the airbags and the helmets that people are supposed to wear or required to wear on bicycles and motorcycles, it's all of a piece philosophically. And if you accept that idea that the government has a legitimate right to forcibly control you, not because of anything you've done to anybody else, but to keep you safe, to keep you healthy, then there's no end to the micromanagement that we might be subject to.
I want to make sure and remind people, of course, they should check out epautos.com. You can also go to ericpetersautos.com, but it's even easier to go to epautos.com. There is no other libertarian car guy, as far as I'm concerned, and you look at all the stuff that's there, and you know that even items you're going to miss, Eric is going to be on top of, and it's a great community of people. It's a wonderful site to get to know and to visit regularly. epautos.com, and of course, we'll link to it at tomwoods.com/673. Until next time, Eric, looking forward to talking to you, and just keep gathering items, and we'll keep having episodes.
Thanks, Tom. Always a good time.
All right, everybody, tomwoods.com/673 is where you want to go. Let's see, what's coming up? Tomorrow, we're going to be talking to Eddie Craig, who's going to talk to us about what you should do if you're pulled over by the police. So that's always a fun subject to talk about. Next week, we'll finally get to the subject of Venezuela. I've had a lot of requests for that topic. Jonathan Haidt returns to the show once again next week. We got a bunch of great episodes coming up next week. If you've been enjoying the show, consider becoming a supporting listener at supportinglisteners.com, and you can join us in the private Facebook group. But we have many, many other goodies, even if you don't use Facebook. And check that out at supportinglisteners.com. So it's Eddie Craig tomorrow. Thanks so much for listening, everybody.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.